You are listening to episode 75, EMDR Therapy with Children, with your host, Jackie Flynn.
Welcome to Play Therapy Community Podcast, providing connection, information, and inspiration to child therapists all around the world. Here's your host, a licensed psychotherapist, a registered play therapist, and my mom, Jackie Flynn.
Hi there. Thank you so much for joining us in another episode of Play Therapy Community Podcast. It means the world to me that you're joining us and taking time out of your day to be with us on this podcast. Okay, so at the time of this recording, it's late August and schools are preparing to reopen amidst this COVID-19 pandemic. Oh, it's so very different this year. There's so many options that parents are facing with, do they send their kids to school in person or online? And if they're doing online, which options do they choose, real time or for the child to do it on their own? And there's also a hybrid option. It can be really overwhelming. I've met with many parents during parent consultations, and some have scheduled sessions to just kind of manage all of these decisions and make a decision that's right for them and their family. It can be overwhelming. I'm a parent as well, so we've chosen the online option. My child's going until 11th grade, so we'll see how that goes. I know when we first started doing the online therapy, which I've been doing it for years, but I hadn't done the online play therapy with young kids until this pandemic, and I've really loved it. There's a lot of unexpected benefits, and I've had great experiences with it. It did come with a learning curve, but I was pleasantly surprised. So if you haven't checked out some of the YouTube videos that I've posted, there's some free workbooks and some techniques that you could use. But I think what's most important is connecting with the clients, which can totally be done online. I love just child-centered play therapy, just being there with the child and doing the tracking and the reflecting and connecting with the child through play. Play is so very powerful. Okay, so today's episode is all about EMDR therapy with children. So EMDR stands for eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. I first heard about this type of therapy in grad school during my group therapy class. Grad student that was supporting us at that time, or actually the doctoral student, had mentioned that she was trained in EMDR therapy and how it could help with that. So I was like, oh, that's interesting. I've never even heard of that. So I kept that in the back of my mind. And then when I went to search for that training when I was like postgraduate and I was getting ready for the transition from being a professional school counselor to a private practitioner, a licensed mental health counselor, I looked for the training and I found out about IMDRIA, the International Association. It's Eye Movement Desensitization Reprocessing International Association, EMDRIA. So it is amazing. At that time, it was a little heavy on my budget. I wasn't making much money. So it was a big decision whether I was going to do it. So I did, with the support of my mom at that time. She's just amazing. I miss her every day. She died at the time of this recording about 5 years ago. But it was a gift that she's given me that was one of the best gifts ever. I changed professionally and personally during this training. It is incredible. So being a child therapist, I'm a registered play therapist working with children and teens mostly, but I do work with many adults. Now I'm certified in EMDR therapy, and I'm also a consultant that teaches other, mainly child therapists, how to use EMDR therapy with their clients with fidelity. But I do work with many adults myself, as do many of my consultees that are either going through the certification process or on the tail end of their basic training. So it is amazing. I mean, the power of EMDR is incredible. It goes to where conceptualization and understanding and insights and words cannot go. It truly helps people to reprocess their trauma. So let's talk about trauma just quickly. Trauma is a disturbing or distressing event in someone's life. So we think of it as capital T trauma and the lowercase t trauma. Capital T trauma is like the really big stuff. And that could vary, you know, whether it's big or not for one person to the next. But when I think of capital T trauma, like maybe witnessing a violent crime or being the victim of a violent crime or a divorce. Many of my child clients go through a divorce in their family or a move or some type of abuse or medical trauma, things of that nature. And the lowercase t traumas are still impactful on the child's or the client's life, but not as much. So that may be, and again, it varies what's capital T and lowercase t trauma from person to person, but in a play at school and they forget their lines, or the fact that their friend moved and they had to, you know, go through the rest of the year sitting by themselves at the cafeteria table. Now, I have met a couple of people over the years that the thought of categorizing it into capital T and lowercase t trauma is upsetting. I get this part. They think, who are we as clinicians to really determine whether this is capital T or lowercase t trauma? It if it's a trauma for the client, we need to treat it as such. So I do talk to the clients about capital T and lowercase t traumas just to kind of give them a gauge, but I let them know that anything that is impacting them is something that we are going to focus on. So when we engage in the first phase of EMDR, so there's 8 phases of EMDR, but when we engage in the very first phase, which is history taking phase, we look at all of the, as many as we have access to, the distressing and disturbing events that's happened in that person's life, even way back to utero. We have emotional memories from 5 months in utero. Is that amazing or what? So you can have emotional memories that don't even link to cognitive memories. It can be pre-verbal and they can show up in the body. We call it somatic memories. Also during that history taking phase, we really look at some of the positives in the person's life. So when I mainly work with children and teens, I will engage both the parent and the caregiver, parent or the caregiver, in this history-taking process, as well as the child. So as a registered play therapist, I incorporate play therapy all throughout all 8 phases, and I do this with the history-taking phase too. So we'll may do a playful timeline or a sand tray that really shows their experiences. And some of the experiences may be pre-verbal, and we may not even have access to all of the information. I know many adoptees, they don't know their history or their family of origin or what happened when they were in utero, when their biological mother was pregnant with them. So it doesn't rely on just knowing everything piece by piece. We can even have very limited information, but have great success with this. So also during this phase one, we really pay attention to the client's capacity to adequately just regulate their body. So we look at all kinds of stuff, their history, their capacity to regulate. We look at their support system. We look at their resources, what they do when they're experiencing distressing times in their life right now. And also we really determine whether it is good timing for the therapy. If the child is getting ready to, say, move, and you only have 2 more sessions, it wouldn't be good timing to start EMDR therapy with that client. You may want to, you know, advise them once they get settled to seek out an EMDR therapist in their new area that they're living in. And you can support that as well by giving them referrals or showing them the network where they can find some EMDR therapists wherever they are. And now we're doing EMDR therapy online. And I have to say, I've had great success with that as well, especially when I'm integrating the play therapy techniques. Okay, so once you have a solid history and it's like, okay, this is good timing for the client to pursue EMDR therapy. They're able to regulate. They can remain stable. There's really, not that there has to be an absence of secondary issues, but really explore any secondary issues that may prevent just a positive treatment of the client. What that means, I'll give you an example of that. Secondary issue may be they may be going through a divorce, so there may be some legal proceedings, or if it's an adult, they may be receiving compensation for their disability. So if they don't have a disability anymore, then that may change their capacity to receive their compensation. So, you know, there's some very unique situations out there. So that is looked at in phase one, the history taking phase. When I do it with children, we'll do, like I said, some sand tray options. We may do a big, like that big long paper that you get at those home improvement stores. We may do a big timeline on that and walk it through. There's lots of creative ways that you can get a good solid history. And then after phase one, we engage in the preparation phase, which is phase two. Now, this phase two, in my opinion, is, you know, they're all important, all the phases, but it is the most important out of all of them because it's really preparing the client for EMDR therapy. So when I work with kids and teens, they have limited life experience. They are not miniature adults. Their brains are still developing. So there's some extra things that we may do with or may need to do with children that we don't do with adults. So first, we need to discuss the framework of EMDR with them. Even the little ones, I may say it in a developmentally appropriate way, like, oh, we're going to do something different. And with some of the parts of EMDR, we have them move their eyes back and forth, just as, you know, your eyes would go back and forth if you were in your REM part of your sleep, the rapid eye movement. And we practice a little bit to, we call it bilateral stimulation, activating that right and that left hemisphere alternatively throughout the fourth phase and also through the beginning phases as well. So we talk about the framework and what to expect, because when people have an idea of what to expect, they feel safer. And it is so important to really keep a pulse on the client's just perception of safety throughout the process, because when someone feels safe, they are more flexible to lean into the process. And that's where we get the good therapy work done, regardless of the type of therapy that it is. And then I also I have a YouTube video, EMDR with Kids. I'll send that link to the parents so that they can get a few visuals of what it looks like and really just have a good idea of what to expect. Also, that phase two is really a time to strengthen and really build and strengthen that therapeutic relationship. The therapeutic relationship is absolutely the most important part of the process. So the client feels connected and they feel safe. They feel like they can go into these difficult spaces with support. So I personally love child-centered play therapy. When you engage in child-centered play therapy, I mean, there's so many amazing techniques out there that is more directive and not child-centered. So I kind of, I go along the continuum from directive to non-directive. But child-centered play therapy really sends a message to the client, hey, I matter. I'm with this person. I have choices. So it has a feeling of I'm cared about, I'm significant, I'm important. And those are a lot of the cognitions that many of our clients are struggling with. Child-centered play therapy by itself can be very healing. When a client can play, they are in a state of flexibility. And when you're in a state of flexibility, then you are in a state of we look at that rigidity chaos continuum that Dr. Siegel talks to us about how trauma can create either rigidity or chaos or both, and they can go back and forth. Play can put them in that middle ground, which is therapeutic in itself. So I love using child-centered play therapy for the beginning stages of EMDR in this phase too. So what that looks like is as the child's playing with nurturing, aggressive, or expressive toys, we track and we reflect feeling and content. So it may sound like, oh, you picked that up. Oh, that one is moving towards that one. Oh, you're all finished with that one. Now you're on to something else. You like to stir that around. Oh, you made something new. So it does sound very different, and it does present with a lot of talking. So I have had clients say, you're talking too much. So I really attuned to the client, which is really helpful and healing. Okay, so also in that phase two with the kids, really do some of these play-based techniques to make sure that they are able to obtain a state of emotional equilibrium. Can they self-soothe? Can they regulate their emotions? I love using the eye roll breathing, which is interestingly a really effective way to regulate your emotions as your eyes go back and forth. And the big loud sigh, elephant-based breathing. We do, there's so many. Circle breathing. Scan your body, breathe into the ground. We do the 5-4-3-2-1 sensory technique. All of that, just ways to help them to ground and be calmer in their nervous system. So there are several different ways to ground, but I think of definitely one way really puts the client in the present moment by just really paying attention to their senses. What are five things you hear, five things you see, four things you hear, three things that you can touch, two things you like to taste, and one thing you like to smell. But another way you can ground is to just imagine breathing in your nose all the way down to like 6 inches into the ground, and then breathe out through your mouth and imagine pulling it up from the ground. That's another way to use that just earth imagery for grounding. All of it can be so very powerful. There are a ton of play-based grounding techniques that you can use. And so it's important, what you do with a little kid, it can be very different than if you do it with a teen or an adult. So, for example, with a child, when you do, you would call it the butterfly hug. You may pretend that it's a butterfly and they tap on one side, then the other. But if you do it with an older teenager or an adult, you may just say, let's tap that in and skip on the word butterfly so that they're a little bit more connected to, and they don't feel like it's below their developmental level. Also, we want to make sure that the client can, in this phase two, expand their window of tolerance. The window of tolerance is right in between the state of hyperarousal, where we just have that, it's just like too much, just over activated. And we either want to fight it out or we want to get out of dodge, that fight or flight. And then underneath the window of tolerance is a hypoarousal, and that's like that shutdown, that freeze response. So we want to expand the window of tolerance so clients can tolerate the therapy. And a lot of times, especially in the basic training, when EMDR trained therapists go for that initial training, sometimes it's 5 days, sometimes it's over the course of a couple of weekends. But sometimes they're taught that butterfly hug and a calm place visualization activity that incorporates all the senses, and the a container where they can contain things. With children, we usually do way more than that because I think of it as just the power of preparation. If you're going to paint a room, preparing the room for the paint may take a long time, but you're going to get way better results, and the actual painting itself is easier then. So I tend to spend a lot of time, or a lot of effort. Time varies depending on the client, you know, the individuality of their capacity to just really, you know, all of those pieces, tolerate the strong emotions, to regulate themselves, all of that, how the therapeutic relationship is going. But I do spend a lot of time or effort into preparation because I want to make sure that they're ready. What clinicians, if they don't spend enough time in there, what they experience sometimes are ab reactions. And that's just a really kind of out of proportionate response to something that comes up in the sessions. So it may look like the client just shuts down. They just really go hyper-aroused or hypo-aroused, and you kind of lose them for a while. They're disconnected. Or that can make to where they don't want to come to therapy again. So that good preparation really helps to avoid that. So once the clinician has a solid phase two and they feel like their client's ready to go forward, then they engage in the assessment phase, which is phase three. So that's where you pick out the targets or the issues that they're working on. It may be a memory. It may be an actual kind of experience. So for example, maybe the client has recently watched a movie that has the images of that are just kind of popping in their mind, like intrusive images at nighttime while they're trying to sleep. So we could really target those images. So one thing that trauma brings with it, which this is the nature of trauma, it comes with its felt sensations in the body. And as therapists, we refer to it as somatic sensations. It comes with it any images sometimes, pictures in your mind. It comes with it thoughts about yourself, like I can't handle it, I'm not safe, I'm not good enough, I'm a bad person, or may, you know, come with some positive thoughts, like I have choices, I'm in control. So really the EMDR therapy, the reprocessing part, is moving from that negative thought to the positive thought. So imagine their cognition is, I'm a bad person. It may transition to I'm a good person, or I did the best that I could, or I learned from it. It's really cool how that works. It's not even a matter of convincing the client or having them understand something. It truly reprocesses it in the brain on just a neurological level. So once in phase three, they pick out the target and the issue. Actually, the clinician is the one that does that. You can do it with kids in the sand tray, through artwork. I love the playroom with little kids. It may come out while they're playing with the dolls or while they're at the kitchen set and they are, you know, maybe reenacting something that's happened at home. So once you pick out that target, then you really kind of, you assess whether the client feels safe enough because some of these traumas, and that's what really makes it, you can tell a lot is in session, is it like they're having a memory of what happened, or are they kind of experiencing that it's happening for them in real time, kind of like a flashback. So we look at, okay, are they re-experiencing it right now, or is it just a memory? And then you assess, can they self-soothe with this one? Because if they can't, so as we're targeting that that nightmare that they're having, or a movie that they've watched and those images are coming up, if they can't self-soothe, we may want to break it down into a smaller target, just one little piece of it. So the MDR clinician can really gauge what needs to happen there. And then Just look at their ability to kind of move through their memory network. So many EMDR clinicians, especially when they're first starting to work with a child or a teen, they will, we call it EMD or EMD little r, they will not allow the client to go too far back through their memory network. They'll keep them right on the target. What I mean by that is we could start off, suppose we're having an out of proportionate response to our child said, "I hate you." And it's really disturbing. It's messing with our capacity to connect with our child. We can't look them in the eye, and it's just really huge, and it's upsetting. And you think, well, my neighbor, she, her kid said it in a moment of distress, and you know cognitively the child didn't mean it, but you can feel it throughout your whole body. So when we start to reprocess that, if we were doing EMDR therapy with you, it may go back to earlier memories of just a "I hate you" comment or the way that somebody treated you that's not your child, but it's something that is unhealed, and it's old stuff, but it really creates that big reaction when your child now is expressing this just really disturbing comment to you. So that's what I mean by the memory networks. Sometimes when the trauma is so intense, we don't let people float back to too many things. We pull them right back to what we're working on. And that's something during the assessment phase we're really clear on. Is this something that we want to kind of keep close, or do we want this to generalize and go back far? Now, with children, their life experience is shorter than, so suppose, you know, I'm 46 years old right now. Suppose I were to go through therapy, I may have 4 decades of "I'm not good enough," whereas a child may have 4 years of "I'm not good enough." So sometimes it can reprocess much quicker. Unfortunately, a lot of children have been through so much trauma, though, that it's not necessarily the amount of time that they live that is telling of their just the magnitude of their trauma. It's the amount of experiences. So when you're with the EMDR therapist, and if you're a parent that's listening to this, or if you're a clinician that's like, I don't know if I should refer my child client or teen client to an EMDR therapist, it is helpful with those big cases to seek out someone that's certified, because they're going to have that additional training, that additional experience to be able to manage with some of these more in-depth cases. So once the phase three, the target is identified, the cognitions, and just really have an idea of what you're going to work on, the clinician will go into phase four, and that's a desensitization. A lot of times people refer to EMDR as just this one phase, which it's all 8 phases, but this is the phase where people's eyes go back and forth, or they're activated. There's 3 different ways you could do. We call it bilateral stimulation. You can do it through the visual means, tactile means, or auditory means. So with kids, it may look like you are engaging in sword play or doing high fives from one side to the next. They may be stomping. They may have maracas and playing on one side to the next. But with maybe a teen, and some kids engage in EMDR therapy like this, they may be holding some electronics, the buzzers that buzz from one side to the next. And what that does is it stimulates the brain in a bilateral fashion and helps move through the trauma. So during phase four, the client, even little kids, I've even used EMDR therapy with children as young as 3, 3 and a half, 4, and as old as 82. So it really, I mean, the brain, that neuroplasticity is amazing. And EMDR, there are some, I'm kind of getting off tangent here, but when they do brain scans, sometimes they'll see changes in terms of like thicker parts of the brain after this reprocessing. It helps the brain to have a greater capacity for stress, and they'll see just physical changes in the brain, which is incredible. But through this phase four, that's the desensitization phase, the therapist will just direct the client to think of the issue, whatever it is that they have determined what they're going to work on, whether it's the memory, you know, in our nightmare example or the bad movie example, just think of the worst part of that movie. I have them just kind of tell the story, because when you tell the story, it brings it up from the bottom part of the brain up to the top part of the brain. And just imagine that you have a remote control and you could pause right there at that worst part. So you do that, and then you move forward with the phase four, the desensitization. So the therapist is going to really assess for any new insights or any emotional, sensory information, any behavioral shifts. And then they may say some things, although their talking is very limited because we want to keep them in their feeling part of their brain. But they may say some things in the EMDR world. We call them cognitive interweaves. And then they assess the level of disturbance. And as the reprocessing goes on, then the goal is, which is really cool how it works, the emotional charge goes down. Sometimes it'll flare up because it kind of accesses other things that may be in there. But bringing the emotional charge out of when they go back to whatever it is that they're working on. So the therapist will just continually go back and forth. With kids, we get really creative with, like, does it feel extra small, medium, large, extra large, or large? And you'll see it go down. I remember when I first started doing this work, I was like, oh my goodness, are they for real? Is this really feeling less, or are they just telling me that it's feeling less? And after, you know, of course, there are some clients that they want to please you, so they may report a false positive. But in my experience, it's been really rare. And then once the client has reprocessed that, then we go in, or we've desensitized it, lowered down the emotional charge that is associated with the issue that they're working on. And then they engage in phase five, which is the installation process. So that's when we look at the positive belief, which may be, you know, I am good enough, or I did the best I could. It, you know, varies depending on what they're working on. So that's also something. That one tends to go a little bit quicker. It's the meat of the therapy, in my experience, is phase two, the preparation, and phase four, where you're doing the desensitization. So once they get to phase five, the installation, that's where you just ride that positive cognition home. So when you think about, I am good enough, or I did the best I could, or whatever that positive thought is now, how true does it feel in that 1 to 7 scale? And again, with kids, it's like, does it feel a little bit true, medium true, large true, or extra large true? So we can kind of gauge that, and then we have them hold together that memory and the positive thought. And then the child or the teen, or, you know, works with all ages, but specifically as a child therapist, we do some play-based ways to help the clients just scan their body. And during this body scan, they learn how, and we do this in phase two too, so they even know what I'm asking. They learn how to really pick up on just those inner sensory experiences that, tightness in your chest, or that fluttery feeling in your stomach, or that knot in your throat, or your teeth are gritting. Just really become aware of their somatic sensations. And then the therapist will do a little bit more bilateral stimulation to help work through. There's even this this technique called pendulation, where you can rock from where that somatic sensation is in their body to where it's not, and you could help lower that activation level is what we call it, that way as well. And then once a client has done a body scan and we feel like we've worked through that, then we engage in just closing out the session. That's really important with all clients, regardless of age, but specifically with my child and teen clients, especially since they are undergoing, like, you know, their brain is still developing, so their capacity to regulate their emotion are already limited. So want to make sure that, you know, if you're an EMDR clinician listening to this, make sure that you carve out enough time at the end of your session to make sure you can help bring them back to the present and do a little bit of positive resourcing, go back to the positives in their life and help get them. I think of the metaphor of like when someone goes for a outpatient surgery, they sew them up and they bandage them up. That's kind of like what we do in the closure session. We bring them back to the present so that when they are, you know, if they're going back to school or if they're going home, they're able to be more at a state of regulation, which really, you know, if they go home and they have behavioral outbursts, that could be, you know, hard on the family as much as it can make the parent not want to bring their child back to therapy, because it does, you know, it seems to make things worse and the child feels the effects of that. So carving out time for closure is a must in my book. And I love just kind of going back to play, that child-centered play therapy, reconnecting with the child in the I'm with you way. So after that, the child leaves and they go home, and when they come back to the next session, we do what we call, you know, it's the phase 8, the reevaluation, just check in. Hey, when you think about that, whatever it is, I want you to just scan your body, notice what you're feeling in your body, and you just kind of look to see if it's still there, because when the client's in between sessions, reprocessing still can occur, so new stuff can come up, so you can address that. So that's what EMDR therapy looks like with children. So it can vary from client to client. So for example, if a client is struggling with the effects of attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, then the therapist may be moving around and very playful and may need to keep the sets very short. Or if a child is struggling with DID, you know, just that dissociative identity disorder, and they may be experiencing different realities. So all of that, it's important to get consultation, to get special training, to work within your scope of practice. But EMDR with kids is incredible. I know at one point people were kind of questioning whether it could even work with children, because they don't sit there like adults on the couch just watching your fingers go back and forth. And it does work with children. It works really well. There's some amazing pioneers in the field. I know when I first got my basic training, there wasn't a lot of kid information during that training. So since then, there's been several people, not a whole lot, but several people that have done research and really kind of made way for child therapists to be able to use this incredible type of therapy with kids. So one of the first books that I got was Ana Gomez's book. So if you haven't heard of Ana Gomez and you're an EMDR trained therapist, definitely get her book. She has, through this COVID pandemic, she has some other supports too, like that, you know, clinicians can use for the bilateral stimulation, and really, it's incredible. So she has some different products that you can use to support your work. So Ana Gomez, right now at the time of this recording, I'm actually excited. At the time of this recording, this training is tomorrow, but Annie Monaco is, she's just incredible. I haven't actually met her, but looking at some of the stuff that she's had, has online, and looking at the different trainings that she has to offer, and some colleagues speak really highly of her. She is one of the people that helps child therapists really learn how to use EMDR therapy with children. Also, Anne Beckley Forrest, she's, you know, they're both registered play therapists, but she has some great, great training. So I know also Carolyn Settle. Whoa, I took a training of hers right afterwards. I bought like all these fidget spinners. It was so good. So anything from Carolyn Settle or Robbie Adler Tapia, there's a good book out there. And Alyssa Kalbeck, she's somebody that I met during my recent Innovative Child Therapy Symposium. She's a registered play therapist and she's a consultant. She's excellent. I really enjoyed talking to her. She has like a practicality to her to make it understandable for the clinicians that she helps. And some of the people that I worked with as a consultant but are now pursuing their consultant status, I think specifically of, oh my goodness, I'm drawing a blank of what her name, Aspen Gowers. I went up to Canada and did my 8 phases of EMDR therapy training for children and adolescents, integrating play therapy techniques, a course there. And Aspen is so good. She is so thorough, and she's also trained in synergetic play therapy. Lisa Dion is one of my favorite, oh my goodness, one of my favorite clinicians in the whole world. She's a game changer of somatic work with kids. So she has the synergetic play therapy. Aspen's trained in both. So also Marshall Lyles, he's a consultant that's also a registered play therapist. One of his big jams, one of many, is sand tray therapy. So if you're a clinician listening to this, we are fortunate right now to have some really, really good people to turn towards when we need some training of how to use EMDR therapy with kids. So if you're not trained in EMDR therapy yet, but you would like to be trained in it, which it's a must to be trained before you even think about using it, because it's a very complex type of therapy that you need to know how to do it, be trained, and have that, you know, that thumbs up to go forward with it, to engage in it. But I urge you to visit emdria.org. Emdria.org, and on that site you can see their training options, and you can also get a feel for just the community. The EMDR community is incredible. There's lots of research behind this. There's lots of different ways that in populations that you can use it with. So, for example, imagine that you're a therapist that mainly works with clients that are struggling with eating disorder, or you're working with clients that are struggling with addiction, or ADHD, or and just anything. You can get specific training. You can see all the trainings on the emdria.org website. Now, there are other places to get EMDR training, but EMDRIA, the EMDRIA International, EMDR International Association, is a gold standard. So that's who I'm trained in, and that's definitely the one that I prefer. Okay, hey, this has went on for like 42 minutes, so I know this is a long one. I usually don't do really long ones like this, but EMDR is my passion, and I wanted to just kind of, my big goal from this episode is just to let you know that EMDR can be really effective with children and adolescents, and what it looks like, so it doesn't seem so mysterious. There's 8 phases, and you can integrate play therapy techniques in there, or some clinicians integrate dialectical behavior therapy, DBT or CBT. So it's just a really, really amazing type of therapy. All right. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you would like the show notes, to be sure to visit www.playtherapycommunity.com. playtherapycommunity.com and just click on podcast. Also, you'll see that I have a membership site there. So if you need any play therapy resources, definitely click on there. I have lots of tips and techniques and interviews. I had Joya Cook on there talking about some of the books that she's written in her process. There's also mini training, so much on that. And if you are an EMDR clinician and you're looking for a consultation or training, be sure to visit JackieFlynnConsulting.com. All right. Thank you so much. Take care. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Play Therapy Community Podcast. Be sure to check out the show notes for this episode and explore our growing members' library of play therapy-related resources at www.playtherapycommunity.com. Prepare to be informed, equipped, inspired, and supported.